We're talking about the Uinta Basin, investigations of paranormal and unusual mysterious activity in that neck of the woods, in particular in the Skinwalker Ranch. Erica Lukes has been on the ground, has developed a network of folks who have helped her, witnesses who've been there when these strange things have happened. If you were not listening an hour ago, we had some new information. Sources close to the new owners of the Skinwalker Ranch say that they've launched a new study, a reinvigorated analysis of what's going on the property, installed a whole bunch of new surveillance gear. They're collecting information, and it's already paying off. They have shared with me some photos that were taken, three different photos of unusual objects that were seen in broad daylight. There are additional photos and videos, I'm told, about orbs that are seen day and night. And there's some creature-type incidents that they're not ready to talk about yet, but it sounds like that study is fired up, and that's good because, the NIDS team that was there for a number of years did some amazing work. It's been documented, and it's become well-known all over the world as a paranormal Disneyland of sorts. Erica Lukes is one of those who's been pursuing these various mysteries, and in a moment we're going to hear some more about the kinds of things that she's found out. Stick around. More to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Erica, one of the stories that really grabbed my attention about Skinwalker, the kind of stuff that gives me goosebumps, there's two of them. One is like the paranormal, the poltergeist-type stuff that happens where things move around, and it seems to be somebody playing mind games with the people who lived on the ranch property. The other was the different creatures, in particular this bulletproof wolf. It was shot five or six times, and then it just ran off into the bushes and vanished. Have you heard any stories about creatures like that or the same wolf?
You know, we have, in fact, Ryan Burns has mentioned the same type of creatures that he has seen. I have spoken with a couple different people who are actually Native American, and they were not by Skinwalker, but they were in different places throughout the Western United States, and they had similar experiences, or family members had similar experiences, where they saw an extremely large creature, a wolf, that was behaving strangely, and the people would grab a firearm and shoot this creature several times, and there would be no effect on this creature. And so what is that? Is that a skinwalker? We don't know, but this is typical. This is something that you hear, and it's not just specific to Skinwalker.
The mind game aspect is both disturbing and intriguing. The idea that it seems to be generating something that would provoke a reaction. I don't know if it's feeding off the energy or the fear or something like that. As we mentioned before the break, Frank Salisbury had used the term UFO display in the title of his book, and I've heard something similar from Bob Bigelow. He calls it a performance in an interview he did with us, is that what happened on the ranch in all cases seemed to be a performance, that what they saw, they were allowed to see. It was on purpose. It wasn't something incidental that just happens and they happen to be there as a witness. It was on purpose so they would see it. And it makes you wonder what's going on. Do you have a take on whether it's a performance? And if so, what they have in mind?
This is a common theme when you're investigating reports. And I've investigated cases. Specifically, there was a case in Dugway where you have these objects that appear in front of people. And interestingly enough, a lot of times you have to use infrared technology to see these objects, but they're very clearly there and they are making an attempt, the people that are witnessing this believe, to communicate with them, to show themselves. And I believe now that we're seeing more and more of the orange orb sightings over densely populated areas, and whatever these objects are, they very clearly, in my opinion, want to be seen. I mean, they are right there, and they almost appear to be communicating with the witnesses, the observers. I think over in Hechtstallen, there were examples where Erling Strand and his group would flash the laser lights in a sequence, and these objects would repeat the same sequence back. So they're communicating, they're making themselves known. Whatever we don't know what it is, but it is behaving intelligently, and that is incredibly thought-provoking, unusual, and that means that we need to get our act together and get some good research done on this.
You know, we had heard from some of the Norwegian folks who've been involved in that ongoing long-term study, and you know, Americans who follow this know of that only as strange lights. The Norwegian scientists had told us that there is a whole range of what we would call paranormal activity associated with those lights that they discarded. They disregarded it as they collected stories from eyewitnesses who had seen the lights. They didn't want to hear about other creatures and Bigfoot and things like that. They thought it was superfluous or extraneous information, so they tossed it out. But there are decades of that kind of activity there, the same as there is are decades of similar activity at Yakima, Sedona, Dulce. It seems like there's always a at least not in the Norwegian case, of course, but in North America, at least, there's always a strong Native American connection. I've never been able to figure out what that connection is. Maybe you have an idea.
You know, I think that it's probably, I mean, gosh, this is so multi-layered, but I think that in a lot of regard, perhaps these indigenous people understood, they respected our environment. They understood that there were specific places that were portals, and you know, energy or different dimensions would intermingle with us, and they stepped back and respected that and wouldn't go near there or protected people. And so I don't, you know, the whole thing is so perplexing and fascinating. But I think that we need to step back, and we need to understand that when we research this, there are so many aspects to go into this, and we have to understand Native cultures, we have to understand the folklore and where they're coming from, and we have to have a reverence for the land and for nature, because we just don't know what we're dealing with.
We'll come back to Skinwalker and the Uinta Basin, I think, when the phones open up, but I want to ask you about a couple of the things that you worked on. This was, it's Isaac Coy, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the name right, but it's a story that deals with, I had never heard this before, about sexual abuse cover-ups at UFO conferences.
You know what, this is, and the two are not related. Isaac Coy was okay. He is a great researcher. He's contributed a lot, and there's been a bit of drama in the UFO field, and hopefully that will be resolved like adults can resolve situations. But with regard to the sexual abuse, and the bottom line is there are women in this field, and there are not, we don't have ethics, we don't have boundaries. And as a woman, I have been involved with a situation where I personally had someone that was stalking me, and the organization that I worked for knew this and refused to step in and protect me. And not only that, they allowed that information to be used to try to discredit me. And so this is common. And this is something that as a woman in the field, I take great offense to, and I don't want this to happen again. And I definitely call on organizations to enforce ethical boundaries, to enforce all of the things that they put in their books that they say are the standards of their organizations. And it was a truly, for me, a hard event, but I believe that I can hopefully shine a spotlight on this and encourage change in the field and encourage other women to support each other and stop this type of behavior from happening.
Yeah, I haven't been to a UFO conference in a while, but I had no idea this was going on. It was a male-dominated field for a long time. I think the more women investigators and activists in the field is definitely a positive, but I had no idea that was going on.
You know, it is. I mean, it definitely is a good old boys club. And there's some, I think because I got the thing, if you're a woman and you're relatively attractive, then you're only getting to the top because you're an easy target, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And that's been incredibly difficult to have that kind of behavior, that those kind of comments leveled towards me, because I know that it's not the case. It shouldn't even be an issue. And this would discourage any woman from coming into the field. And this needs to be addressed. It needs to be addressed by other researchers in the field who support bad behavior like that. It needs to be addressed by MUFON and the major organizations. And until we're willing to do that and behave ethically, then we really won't make a lot of progress.
There was a case that you investigated, American Airlines 434, that I wanted to see if you could encapsulize it for us, tell us what was involved. And I guess you got some evidence, but some evidence was never produced.
Yeah, this was an incredible case. And my friend, Pat Daniels, he's the host of Fringe Radio, has been on the air for a long, long time. He lives in the Salt Lake Valley. He's a ham radio operator, and he likes to scan the frequencies. He's been doing this for many, many years, for decades. And one night after 12 o'clock, he was scanning the police scanner, and he overheard a series of exchanges between the air route traffic control and an American Airlines pilot. And the first transmission, that the pilot or the crew was saying that there was an object that seemed to be keeping pace with his plane, he got the impression that the pilot was very concerned. And in the next transmission, you can hear a little bit of the exchange between the air route traffic control and the pilot or the crew saying, you know, okay, well, what are you saying off to the side? They identify NEFA, Utah. So Pat had never heard anything like this in his decades-long scanning frequencies. So we connected, and after talking to him and then going to the air traffic control site where you can download audio, I could identify that there was, in fact, a portion of that exchange, so I could verify what he was, you know, what took place for him. And then I called in my team, Jeffrey Cox, who was my assistant state director, and I called Bill Puckett, who is excellent in radar analysis. We submitted a FOIA request for radar data, for audio logs and the tower logs, and surprisingly enough, we actually received radar data and a portion of the audio data, and all of this was huge, because the radar data that we obtained was truly unlike anything that we have seen since Stevensville. In fact, Puckett worked on the Stevensville case, and he says in his 15, 20-year career analyzing radar data, he has never seen a case this significant, and that's huge. So it was a great case, and we are extremely lucky to have a portion of the audio with the American Airlines crew talking about this. We hope that other pilots will feel safe and come forward with this, and at some point the FAA will take this seriously and support pilots instead of discouraging them from talking about this.
When I read your synopsis of it, I read it too fast, but it sounded like there was some of the recordings that were not made public. Was that a purposeful omission, or they refused to release it, or just release part of it, or am I remembering that incorrectly?
Yes, you are. You've got such a good memory. Yeah, they did redact a portion of the conversation, and we believe, I have no reason not to believe, that was the portion where the crew member or pilot was saying that this object was keeping pace with the plane. So that was quite curious. I do know from previous experience and current experience that oftentimes when you submit FOIA requests with the FAA, you don't necessarily get what you what you ask for. And sometimes, specifically in the mass sighting of 2014, that case, it's difficult to obtain data for whatever reason.
You know, when I saw when you mentioned NEFI, Utah, it reminded me of a really infamous or famous case. It was from April 18th, 1962, so it's well before your time, but there was a giant fireball that was chased, tracked all the way across the U.S. It landed in NEFI, Utah, then took off and exploded over Mesquite, Nevada, and it was an explosion that was seen all over the West. It was just investigated by the Blue Book folks, who said when it landed in NEFI, it knocked power out to the town. And they described it as it was a meteor. They explained it away as a meteor that landed and then took off again. I don't know if you've ever been to Nephi and investigated that case, but it's a pretty good one if you want to dig into it.
You know what? That is a great case. In fact, it's really funny because my friend Paul Dean, who's an Australian researcher, sent me a bunch of information on that, and I've been digging into old Blue Book cases with regard to Utah, and you know, you've got the Tremont and case, and then the Woody Harris case, and there's some really intriguing cases that I'm actually going to be talking about all of them. So I'm going to look into this as well. This is great. And when you look back, you can just find all this amazing stuff.
Utah is a weird place. You got a lot of weird stuff.
You ain't kidding.
Creatures. And I want to go back to the Skinwalker, the Uinta Basin for a second, sort of an example of a concentrated weirdness. They had a lot of oil fields there. Is there a connection, you think, to some of the weird stuff that goes on and minerals such as oil? Are they there to check out natural resources?
My gut instinct would be absolutely. They're here doing something, and there is a lot of evidence to support that they are in areas where there is a specific mineral or rare earth content. And you see this here in Utah, where we have repeated sightings over the Kennecott Copper area, where you've got gold and copper, and then you see sightings here with relation to the salt. You know, we've got the salt flats, and then you look at the region here in the Atacama Desert in Chile, where they have similar types of sightings. And so you also hear Allison Cruz has talked about the fact that she is observing objects that are running around these orbs are moving along abandoned mine shafts. So what are they doing there? I mean, we just don't know, but it is curious, and it would lead one to speculate that they are perhaps utilizing minerals in some capacity, in some way.
And the Ouray oil fields, that's been active.
Yes, it has been very active. And my contact there who works there, he actually doesn't work there any longer, but he and his crew would see things all the time. And he contacted me, and I've been working with his family. He has a mother and a grandmother who's 93, and they have had really significant sightings. In fact, his grandmother, I just have to mention this, was back in the 70s, was rock hounding near Vernal, Utah, and she wandered off, and then her family became concerned, and they found her a couple hours later, and she was disoriented, and she had radiation burns all over her. That she went to the doctor, and the doctor couldn't figure this out. But she had, along with her daughter and her son, they've had pretty interesting encounters over their lifetime in this area.
Wow. You know, in a couple of minutes, we'll go to the phones, and if there are folks who live in the Uinta Basin or that area or near the Skinwalker Ranch, and you have some stories about things that you've seen, I hope you'll consider calling in. There's a friend of ours, Ryan Layton, who I know is listening tonight. I hope he'll call in and share with us some stories about the early days of the ranch when things were really going on hot and heavy. Our guest is Erica Lukes. Erica, we're going to a break here in about 30 seconds, but on the other side, I want to ask you, if you want to get into it, if there was something going on with MUFON, because you were state director and volunteer of the year, and then you left to go on with this other organization. And I don't know if there's a larger story there or not, but I'll ask you on the other side, and then we'll take calls and questions and comments from our listeners. We're talking with Erica Lukes about UFOs and other matters related to Skinwalker Ranch in the Uinta Basin. We're talking with Erica Lukes, UFO investigator, paranormal investigator, who's been looking into activity in the Uinta Basin and Skinwalker Ranch and other areas of Utah, and has moved on from MUFON, is hooked up with a new UAP organization that's looking at a broader picture of strange mysteries. So we're going to go to the phones in a moment with your calls and questions and comments, Skinwalker Ranch or the Basin or anything else. We'll be right back. So, Erica, one quick question before we go to the phones. Is there a story behind you leaving MUFON for this other organization? I guess I'm hoping that it's not something bad, because Jan Harzan, the guy who's running MUFON now, I think he's doing a great job. So I guess I'm crossing my fingers here.
Oh, you know, I will say that, honestly, the people, it is the people, the really amazing people that volunteer their time in MUFON that make it such a great organization. And I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't talk with James Clarkson, who's the Washington State Director, or Ruben Uriarte, or, you know, Ben Moss or Tony Andiola. I mean, there's so many brilliant people that work for MUFON, but it is a large organization, and it's broken, and it needs to be fixed. And I think that the unfortunate thing is the morale is not where it needs to be. And I think that there are also, unfortunately, lower level political games that take place, like any organization. But for me, it was incredibly detrimental, and it affected me and my team. And I made the decision, as my assistant state director did, after giving it a really good try, but just enduring some things that nobody should have to endure, that we needed to move on in a positive direction. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, I really hope that MUFON can address some of these problems and support the people that work hard for them, create an environment of cohesiveness, and I think that it is imperative that there is good, strong leadership with regard to this, because that's what this field needs. We need to make change, we need to work together, and we need to rethink and reframe the way we're dealing with this subject. As an investigator, researcher, I look at some of the ways that MUFON is dealing with things, and it wouldn't be my first approach, because we're sitting behind computers and we're investigating cases and closing them, and we're not looking at the data, we're not looking at the bigger picture. And we have to do this. We have to change the way we are doing things, and like I said, we have to have ethical boundaries, and I think sometimes MUFON is a little lax in that regard.
Yeah, you know, the topic, as any listener to this program knows, the topic draws all kinds of people, and it draws people who are interested for personal reasons, or they're blatant profiteers, or they're just crazy saucer nuts who think everything in the sky is from the planet Krypton, and you know, there have to be standards for it. There are also, as you mentioned, some really dedicated folks who work hard and want it to be reputable and do an honest job. So I it's hard. MUFON is a big organization, and it's hard. So I wish them well. Let's take some calls. First time caller John in Columbia, Missouri. Hi, John. You're on with Erica Lukes.
Oh, thank you so much. I always tune in when you and Radio Mysterious' Gray Bishop are driving coast to coast. And Ms. Lukes, I followed your diversity inclusion efforts in this field, and please don't be deterred. Two quick questions. Could both of you speculate on who has purchased the ranch and why the military is continuing to be interested?
Well, I can address a little bit. The new owners don't want to be identified yet. They've got a company. It's an LLC called Adamantium, and I think it's easy to figure out why they don't want to be identified. Bob Bigelow became hounded by all kinds of people who just people asking for money, people identifying him as a front for the CIA. They've called him a drug dealer, all kinds of stuff that's completely untrue. And have assigned all sorts of motives to him. He's studying the ranch because he's captured alien technology and wants to build his own fleet of flying saucers and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I think the new owners saw that and decided they would prefer to be anonymous. I can tell you that they are not military. There is two of the security guys are ex-military, but that kind of experience would come in handy if you want to investigate strange stuff and keep trespassers off. But the new owners prefer to remain anonymous, at least for the time being. They're putting a lot of money into studying this thing, and no, they're not military. But I can certainly see why the military would be interested in it. And Erica, maybe you want to jump in this as well, because Terry Sherman, the rancher who had been on the property, owned the property at the time when this really took off, had said that military folks would pop up from time to time. There were helicopter overflights and strange sort of men in black type folks who would show up. And I'm sure that they were interested in evaluating whether or not whatever is happening there is some kind of a threat or whether or not it could be weaponized. I know that there has been ongoing interest among military folks, that some of the neighbors had been interrogated and there were some military people who left their business cards. I think it makes perfect sense that a military would be interested in what's going on there. But if it, the military wanted to take it over, they would just buy it and then seal it off and we'd never hear anything about it. Erica, you might want to jump into that as well.
You know what? And I think that we see lots of cases, you know, and Fran Rich with NICAP has had some interesting stories over his decades long in the field talking about the military and their involvement on the periphery and things. And so, I mean, they are always keeping an active eye out on things. And when you've got a place like Skinwalker, of course, they're going to be there. And we hear from residents that they do see things like that around the ranch. Right. And same thing with some of the other places, Native American reservations that have a lot of activity. I think that's pretty common. But, you know, I really, really hope that whoever has purchased Skinwalker Ranch now, even though they want to be anonymous, I hope that at some point in time, though, that they will share their findings, at least with researchers that are genuinely concerned about this and have contributions to make, because it's important that we share.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I will make that argument to them whenever I get a chance to speak to them, and I'm hoping that it's an open door. We're going to see. John, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Kurt in Utah. How you doing, Kurt?
Hey, really good. Just wanted to talk about a site in 2011, just over Camp Williams, just south of the data vaults. We were traveling down Redwood Road, which is on the west side of Utah Valley, which is just south of Salt Lake Valley. And it was one light. And as I was driving, I looked off to the west, and I saw it branch off into several lights. And then it branched off into over a dozen different lights into this really weird-looking shape over the skyline, just over the mountains, which was all of Camp Williams up there. They fire mortar range, mortar fire up there. I pulled the car over. I've got a great photo of it, and it just hung there for a while. Other cars pulled off the side of the road. Many people saw it. We've had other sightings. There's the LDS temple there in the valley in Pleasant Grove. I think it's on the east side of the valley up against the Wasatch Front. And the sighting was directly over the temple. It stood there for a while. And so we've had some interesting sightings out here.
You know what, I think that is amazing, and thank you so much for calling in. And if you could maybe send me a message on Facebook or get a hold of me on UFOclassified.com, that would be great, because your experiences are exactly what we need to really put the puzzle together, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, photo would be great to see.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kurt. East of the Rockies, Barry in South Carolina. Hi, Barry. You're on with Erica.
Hello, George and Erica. Buddy, keep up that bumper music. Roxette doing that. She's got the book. Listen, I got two comments and a couple of questions. Starting off with the Brown Mountain Lights. You mentioned it when the show came on tonight. They are 1 hour and 45 minutes from my house. I live in Rock Hill, South Carolina. I'm only 30 minutes from downtown Charlotte, North Carolina. And I have been to the Brown Mountain Light Lookout that looks over the mountains, but it's only been during the day. But listen, my brother-in-law, 20 years ago, he and his brother hiked in there to where the Brown Mountain Lights are. They had seen it from the overlook, and it's right off the Blue Ridge Parkway. And they camped out that night and put out a campfire about 9 o'clock, and about 2 or 3 in the morning, the Brown Mountain Lights up above them, and they said that they kept watching them, and that all of a sudden a UFO-type craft descended out of the middle of those bright lights and basically pulled up to the side of a mountain, and instead of, not a door opened up, but it was like a hazy look, like the it was going into a different dimension or something, and it opened up, and that UFO craft moved into that tunnel-type apparatus and closed off, and the brown mountain lights went off right there in their face. Is your comment?
Oh, my God. That is fantastic. Did he report that anywhere?
Say that again?
Did he report the sighting anywhere?
No. This has been about 20 years ago. And it was before the publicity came out. I met with George Norrie and Tommy Danhauser up in Asheville, North Carolina, on August the 27th of this year. Boy, that George and Tommy, they're great guys. I know them personally. And anyway, Joshua P. Warren was there from Asheville. And he knows a lot about the Round Mountain Lights and has a tour business where he takes people over there in a big glassed-in van type thing, and he shows them where the Brown Mountain Lights are, but of course, obviously, you can't see them until the middle of the night. And but my brother-in-law, well, he and his brother hiked out of there the next day. They said that they were absolutely convinced from then on and right up until today that UFO craft are coming in here, and he said he got the impression that the reason the Brown Mountain Lights are buzzing around in the sky is to attract human beings' attention to the craft that's hidden sort of in those lights that descends and goes into the side of the mountain.
I'll tell you what, Barry, I have your number. In fact, I owe you a call, so I'm going to give your number. I'll pass it on to Erica, and maybe you can help her put together a file on this case. But thanks for calling. It's always great to hear you. We're going to go to our wild card line. Betsy in Washington, who is, I guess, familiar with the Uinta Basin. Betsy, how you doing?
Hi there. I'm doing just fine. I took a trip to the High Uintas in 2005. I've never been there before, but I do a lot of high-altitude backpacking. And I took the road north out of Duchesne, and it comes to a split right and left. I took the right split and went on up, you know, goes through the reservation. And I got to the trailhead, which was a wash in 2,000-pound cows, and I had just bought a brand-new truck, which kind of alarmed me. But I headed into the country there, and I stopped along the way in the evening at a place that wasn't a standard campsite, but just a place you could camp near some water. And the next morning, I was awakened about 6 o'clock by some sound that I didn't recognize. Now, I'd been hiking since I was like 5 years old. I'd been over the west and the mountain west, so I've heard and seen just about everything that, you know, walks on four legs, or sometimes two, and I couldn't figure out exactly what it was, but it must have been at least an eighth of a mile from my camp, and it was relatively loud, but I wasn't too sure what it was, but I couldn't identify it. So it happened, I stayed in that camp, the same camp, one more night. The next morning, about 6 o'clock, here comes this same sound again, but I paid a lot closer attention. And I don't know for sure what it was. I've heard some of those Sasquatch recordings. It didn't sound, you know, exactly like that, but it was relatively loud for, you know, from the distance it was coming. It wasn't a small animal. So I'm never going to know what it was, but it wasn't anything that I've ever heard. And it did give me some thought. I didn't feel afraid, but I just had some thought because I'm a 90-pounder, and I thought, don't have much of a chance with one of those.
Well, Betsy, we'll hear what Erica has to say about that. Thanks for the call.
Before I heard about Skinwalker, so I didn't know that there was anything like that
out
there.
Okay. We're going to get Erica's take on it, and then we're going to try to get one more call in. Thanks for the call, Betsy.
Yeah, thanks, Betsy. And then that is really interesting. And again, I mean, all of this is fascinating, and it builds a larger piece. I mean, it puts a piece of the puzzle together. And so I think that, you know, we hear reports like this from all over the world, and it's curious, and we need to get more information. We need to get people coming forward and submitting reports to databases where they're transparent and where we can all work together to put together the puzzle. What do you think about that, George? Because you've heard of stuff like that.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of weird animals out in the forests, and you know, I'd like to hear a tape of it before I have a judgment on it. But I appreciate Betsy calling in. We have time for one more call. Rich, who's calling from Wyoming, had some sort of a sighting in the Uinta Basin with a bunch of Boy Scouts. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Howdy.
Hey, it was about between 76, 77. We were up in the Uinta Mountain Range, just where the same Uinta Mountain Range the last caller had been in. And we were up there. It was the last night that we were in. We were up there doing a 50-miler, a foot of float type thing. And we were up there, and one of the scoutmasters that we were with kind of wanted to goof around, and he kind of made his own type of Sasquatch call. And we were up there by a red vessel, and the funny thing is we were all standing around the fire, and he did that, and we had a return call, and pretty good sized boulders thrown into the the lake there. The Uinta Mountain Range is kind of interesting. It's one of the only mountain ranges in the United States that's actually developed or set from east to west instead of north to south.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting as far as that's concerned also.
It is.
Thanks,
absolutely.
Rich. Appreciate that call. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to be going to a break here soon. Erica, a reaction to that? I mean, we've heard those stories in Bigfoot lore about a response, and sometimes boulders getting tossed around.
Absolutely. And again, it's just it's a fun thing, and I think that at the end of the day, I love knowing that I get to explore all of this. And with regard to the Bigfoot sightings, I think it's actually a very positive thing that we're dealing with in that regard. But we just need to keep an open mind, and we need to keep the lines of communication going, and we need to share things. We need to move forward in a positive direction, and I hope that we can do that with regard to all of this.
Erica Lukes, thanks very much. This was your first appearance on the show. I promise it won't be the last. Hope you'll stay in touch with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. And we have links to Erica's material on the Coast to Coast website. Coming up next, Alejandro Rojas to talk about the big UFO cases, headlines, and stories of 2016.